Holocaust survivors carry with them some of the most profound information we have about the unfathomable cruelty of the Third Reich. It's a history that challenges our understanding of what humanity is capable of. But nearly 75 years since World War II ended, there aren't many survivors left to share those firsthand accounts. Well, photographer Luigi Toscano has traveled the world collecting as many stories and photographs as he can while he still can, and the resulting exhibit, Lest We Forget, is on view in Kansas City right now. The photographer is here in the studio this morning to share what he's learned. I'm Gina Kaufman. Luigi, good morning.
Good morning.
When did this whole idea start percolating in your mind? Did something trigger it?
You know, when I start this project 4 years ago and I write my concept, so I going out to ask somebody that they can help me. I ask institutions, I ask other institutions, and in the beginning, nobody believes in me. Nobody give me the possibility to realize this project. So then, after two weeks, I met my first survivor, and he motivated me so much that I start this way.
Tell me about that first conversation. What it was that was so motivating?
It was. I remember that was a woman, a survivor, Susan. She came from Charlotte. I met her in Heidelberg, close by my city, Mannheim, and she was a really motivated person. You know, I remember that she tells me in the beginning to our conversation that she said, "Luigi, if you forget the past, we are damned to repeat it." You know, and she tells me, "Please share this with other peoples. Then you will see the doors are open for you for that."
These are close-up photographs you took showing the survivors' faces really specifically, and you've made the conscious choice to make the prints really large, so these are giant faces that the viewer sees, that the viewer looks into. Talk to me about that choice.
The concept is really easy. It's nothing special, you know. It is a black background and my ring light and my camera, you know. And when I write my concept, I'm thinking about what is the best possibility to look somebody in the face, you know. And I think this is one of the way that you can look somebody directly in the eyes. And if you scaled this picture, you know, there are coming a good that impressed you, you know. And also when you bring these pictures in the public space, you know, everybody can see it, you know. Everybody cannot pass away that, you know, that they cannot see it, you know.
The idea of looking into someone's eyes, what does that mean to you?
It is a form of respect. It is a form of directly, and it's a form of true, you know. That is my concept.
Yeah, that eyes are the window into the soul is something that people have
absolutely
said.
Absolutely, absolutely. And sometimes when I show an exhibition, I go also to this exhibition and I'm moving a little bit around, and sometimes I talk with the people. So and I'm really fascinated that the people stay for a couple of minutes and look these people, you know, and it is very nice.
I'll get back to the stories of the actual people you met, their survivor stories. But this exhibit's been traveling the globe, and the reactions to it in some places have been violent.
The greatest shock was in Vienna for me. In May, my picture was attacked three times. First time they made graffitis with swastikas, and and the second time and the third time there was scratched by a knife. And yeah, it was the biggest shock during my tour, you know. And I was
so these are three separate incidents in the same place.
Yeah, and I was really
in Vienna, Austria.
Yeah, I was really helpless. You say helpless, and you know, I remember I stay in the front of the destroyed pictures, and I I was completely alone, and I remember that after I think a half hour, I made a Facebook post and I asked Oskar, what is going on with you? And after this post, you cannot believe that so many young people came to the exhibition and start to repair these pictures. There was a young Muslim group, I remember so clear when they came, Asma, a young Muslim guy, and she asked me, hey, Luigi, would like to repair your picture. I'm a Muslim, you know. Then 10 minutes later came a Catholic guy to me and asked me, hey, Luigi, I would like to help you. And you can imagine after 20 minutes, I think, there was hundreds of young people and stay on the exhibition and they say, hey, Luigi, would like to protect your picture. We would like to protect this art and we will stay here for 24 hours every day. And then I have nothing more in my hand. I lose completely the control of that what's happened, you know. There came thousands of people. They bring flowers, candles, and they, you know, the federal president is coming and said, hey, Luigi, don't give up. Survivors of my project calls me from around the world and say, Luigi, don't give up, don't give up. You know, and that motivated me so much, you know, and, you know.
It must have been very intense to have such a forcefully violent reaction against your work and then followed by, in some ways, an even more forcefully supportive reaction to that.
Yeah, and it was, you know, the beautiful pictures that I saw there was the main rabbi of Vienna is coming to the young Muslim and bring them food, you know. And the rabbi said, hey, it's so wonderful that you are here and that we stay together, you know. And anti-Semitism, racism have no place here, you know. And it is so beautiful that what you do and what you share the world, you know. Or another story, a man flies from Israel to us and only to say thank you, you know. They read about it in the news, what happened in Vienna. They came from Tel Aviv.
To Vienna.
To Vienna. I don't know. and comes to me and to the other guys and say thank you that you do that, you know. And it was, the reaction was amazing after the attacks, you know. And that gives me hope, you know, that gives me really much hope.
When I read your bio, you identify as German-Italian. It sounds like you grew up in Germany.
I was born in Germany. You are not automatically a German when you are born in Germany.
Okay.
Depends on your parents, and my parents are from Italy. So, yeah, I'm Italian citizen.
Can you tell me, talk to me about how you think being a descendant possibly of the nation states most directly implicated in the Holocaust might shape your approach, your perspective, even what drives you to do it?
I think we must believe in our democracy, you know, and this is that what I do, you know. I mean, it's another way what I use, you know. I use it a creative way, you know. And it is so beautiful when young people comes to me and ask me, hey, Luigi, what can we do as a younger generation, you know? And I'm not a teacher, you know, I'm not a leader, you know what I mean? I'm that what I am, you know, and that's okay, you know. And I think I have the special situation. I was born in Germany, you know. I have nothing much to do with Italy, you know, but I'm Italian, you know, and I think it's so necessary that we defend our democracy, you know, that we stand up and that we do something.
When you say our democracy, do you mean democracy wherever it exists?
Wherever there exists, this is one of the survivors tells me, Luigi, this is the best form that we have, you know, and I think. Yeah, you know what's also happened when the democracy going a wrong way, you know, and
yeah, I mean, I was going to say democracy didn't prevent the Holocaust.
That's right, but I think again, I think it is so necessary that we pick up the younger generation, you know, that we say them, hey, you know what's happened when we fail again, you know, and you know what's going on in the world, you know what's going on in Europe, in Germany, also in America, you know, and you cannot close your eyes. And that was my decision when I feel this 4 years ago in Germany, that the situation completely changed, you know. I'm so sad to discuss with my friends and discussing, you know. I will do something, you know. And
take me back to 4 years ago when you felt like something had changed.
You know, when I start my project, I had a similar project with refugees, you know, and the refugees was standing out of Mannheim and nobody see them, you know. And in one day I had a possibility to meet a refugee on the street, you know. There was a classical situation. They asked me for a lighter, and so we start, and hey, what you do, you know, the typical small talk. And I say, hey, I'm a photographer, and what are you? And I'm a refugee from Iran. I'm a Christian, and I flow from Iran to Europe, you know. And I'm living here 3 years outside of Mannheim. I say, what outside of Mannheim? What they mean, you know? And they invite me to come, and I see this really bad situation there, and nobody knows in Mannheim that there was a refugee house in our city, you know?
Can you describe, when you say it was a bad situation, what did you see?
You know, the place was really dirty. There was too much people in a too small room, you know? And I see this two beautiful pictures from Ali, you know, two beautiful children of Ali, sorry. And they broke my heart, you know, they broke my heart. And I say, we must do something. It's not okay that you stay here, you know, that's dirty, the you know. And then I go directly to my to the city of Mannheim in the, you say, city hall, yeah, city hall. And I talk with some people, you know, from the social department, and I say, these people are not in good conditions, you know, so do something, you know. And, you know, and then in until 2 or 3 weeks, I organized a new home for this family, you know. But it was so, you know, so bad to see that the other family stay there in this house, you know. And so I decide I speak with Ali. I say, hey, Ali, we must organize that all these people come in front of my camera. I take pictures and bring it in the public space in Mannheim, in a really public space. So I do this until one day. I photograph, I think, nearly 100, and I print these pictures.
In one day, you
in
photographed
one day. I take this picture and I print it and I bring it in a public space. A popular space in Mannheim, you know. I put it in a big wall.
You were working really urgently.
Yeah, I do that. And it was so necessary. And you know what's, it was so beautiful, you know. There was a, I don't know, describe, there was a wall, you know, and the people write something down and they say, hey, where are these people? And the other said, that are refugees. Hey, need their help? Yeah, they need help. And
so there's a wall where people are writing messages,
yeah,
trying to
yeah,
get
it
information
was not,
about
not Facebook,
other people.
Not Instagram. There was totally analog, you say, analog.
Yeah.
And it was so beautiful to see that, you know, that the people starts a movement, you know, to help. And I think 1 week later, the director of this refugee house calls me and say, "Hey, Luigi, can you write something on this wall that we have enough clothes for the people, that we have enough food now, right now? You know, only what you need is a little bit more medicine, you know." So, and it was
so many needs were quickly met once people knew.
And this experience that inspired me to going in the public space, you know. That was not a new step for me in my, you know, in my, I don't know, career, or, you know. And so I feel it that with doing something in the public space, I can provocate and I can say, hello, look there, what's going on, you know. And this is my, you know, my intention, that to, you know, to... to not teach somebody, you know, only to bring something in the public space. And it is up to you what you're thinking about this, you know. It's not my responsibility, you know.
The stories of Holocaust survivors as compared with what's happening with refugees, like, in the moment, now, that's not new information. And that, to me, is an interesting piece of this, that you are asking people to look in the faces of a story that we've been hearing for nearly 75 years.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you cannot say that the Holocaust is the same that what is the, with the refugee. I think we must clear that the Holocaust was really the most bad things in the world, I said, you know. I will not say that the situation of the refugees are another. It's also really bad, you know. And,
yeah. And the whole... Yeah, needing to decide what things are worse is like...
I will not judge this, you know. I will not judge this. I think it's not okay when people must refuse from his home, you know. And also, you know, children, they died on the sea, you know. That's not okay, you know what I mean. And I think, again, we can do something, you know, we can do something. I have, you know, I travel now the world, you know, I have the possibility to meet many presidents and I can talk with them and I, you know, we have a conversation and I speak also about, hey, do something more, you know, this is, you know, I will motivate them, you know, to do something more and more, you know, that's not enough at the moment, you know.
Your photographs of Holocaust survivors, some of them were taken really recently.
What do you mean recently?
Like, these weren't taken like years ago. Some of these photographs were taken this year, I understand.
Yeah, the concept is also when I decide to coming in a new city to take to bring this exhibition. So I'm looking for survivors from the local area, you know. And also I do that 4 weeks ago when I came here to Kansas City. I had a support of Jutta Behnen is the director of the Goethe Pop-Up Institution here in Kansas City. And she helps me to find out survivors from here. So and then I going there and take the picture.
You talked to a woman by the name of Sonia Warshawski. She's a kind of a local celebrity in Kansas City, especially since a documentary was made about her by her daughter. She goes by Big Sonia. Can you tell her story for people who haven't heard it and what your perspective on her and what she represents is?
You know, I love Big Sonia. You know, I'm really a big fan of Sonia. And she, you know, I will not offend Sonia now. I met so many Sonias around the world, you know, especially in Russia or in the Ukraine, you know. And I can tell you that there are so warmly these people and so, you know, so full of love, you know. And sometimes when I heard her story, you know, I cannot believe that, you know, she is, you know, in this moment, she's so lovely, you know. But this is the answer, you know, to not answer with hate. It's necessary to answer with love, that she said to me, Sonia, you know. And yeah, it is so beautiful. And I remember when I have this appointment with Sonia, she tells me her story and you know, and the story, his story is so bad, you know, so bad. And yeah.
Who else stands out as you think about the people you've met and the stories they've told you? Just, is there a story that sort of like lives with you in your mind as you go from place to place?
Yeah, there is a story. There are many stories. And if you like, I can tell you an example. I remember when I showed this exhibition in Berlin, I sometimes when I create this exhibition, and sometimes I decide to stand here somebody and here somebody. So on this day, I don't know why, on this day I put one portrait of Horst and one portrait of Walter. Horst is a survivor from Germany, and Walter also from Germany, but he lives in Stockholm in Sweden. And, you know, on the opening, the newspaper is coming and to take pictures, and, you know, and 2 days later, Walter calls me from Sweden and asks me, Luigi, what you done? And I say, Walter, I don't know, what you mean, you know, this is Horst, my old school friend, you know.
And they were next to each other on the wall.
Yeah, and they met again after 80 years. And the tragical of this thing is Horst's family was completely erased by the Nazis, and Walter's family was completely survived, you know. And Walter was so motivated to see him again, and they show him all these pictures, you know. There was neighborhood, you know, they live, you know, house and house, you know. And
because this one family has survived, they also have these things,
yeah,
these commemorative things.
You know, and you can imagine, I was completely out, you know. I was completely, I think, what's going on here, you know. And I saw this beautiful child pictures, you know, when Horst was a young boy and Walter was a young boy, you know. And you can imagine, it's so heartbreaking, you know, it's so heartbreaking.
In the course of this project, you did meet someone who could not understand, a survivor, I should say, who couldn't understand why, as a person who didn't have to endure the Holocaust as he did, that you are someone with free will and therefore the ability to do anything with your time, go swimming, have a coffee, that he could not understand why you would choose to revisit these painful memories with people. And in a way, that is a good question.
Yeah, and I remember when I was in Russia, the same question asked me for survivors. And I remember there was really tough guys sitting in front of me. And I remember that they asked me, Luigi, you have nothing better to do? That you described the Holocaust, you take pictures. And, you know, and I answered them, yeah, of course, I have something better to do. You know, I have a little daughter, I can play with them, I can spend my holidays, I can go swimming, you know. But you know what? It is important that I will know your story, you know, and I will share this with the world, you know. And I hope that somebody can read your story, you know. And so, yeah.
I mean, as we speak right now, Jews all over the world are embarking on the high holidays. We'll all be gathering to share apples and honey today. And then a week from now, we'll be atoning for shortcomings and forgiving others their trespasses against us, to use the language of that liturgy. It's always a really intense experience to confront regrets and then ideally to let things go. What have you learned about forgiveness and perhaps its limits in the course of this project?
That's a good question. I learned so many in this project, and I learned so many deep things, you know. And I remember one woman, I met her in Israel. She, you know, she is also a beautiful lady. She, you know, she was really open to me to share her stories. And then I start to speaking German, you know, and she was completely freaked out, you know, and stopped to talking German here in my house, you know. And in this moment, I was really shocked, you know. I doesn't understand what they mean, you know. But she left the room, and 10 minutes later she came back, and she gave me a big hug and said, Luigi, forgive me. But something triggered in my head, you know. And, you know, you can imagine, for somebody, they see when the Nazi killed his little sister, you know. And she said to me, Luigi, I cannot forgive this, I cannot forgive. And I said, yeah, I understand this, you know, but I will invest my hope in you and in other people. And I hope that you're doing better, you know.
Photographer Luigi Toscano, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Luigi Toscano's exhibit, Lest We Forget, is on view through October 6th at the World One Museum in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're off to a break, but KCUR's Central Standard will return in just a minute. In the 1930s, there were two players for the St. Louis Cardinals who went by Dizzy and Daffy Dean, brothers who rose up from humble beginnings and quickly became a national media sensation.
From brothers named Dizzy and Daffy.
Well, Paul, we ought to win 45 ball games this year.
In 1934, right after the Cardinals won the World Series, the two Major League celebrity players took off on a barnstorming tour, playing exhibition games against the best Negro Leagues players in the country. And we're going to talk now with the historian who's written a book about that moment in baseball history and what it says about race, sports, and the media in America going back almost a century. Phil Dixon, good morning.
Good morning to you.
What do we need to understand about who these guys were, what baseball was like at the time, and what this barnstorming tour was all about before we delve into the bigger questions about meaning?
Yeah, well, first of all, we probably need to familiarize people with the term barnstorming.
Yes. Yeah, I have been really, like, troubled by this.
Yeah, barnstorming comes out of the minstrel show days and went into vaudeville. And what it is, it's a series of one-nighters, maybe two-nighters in different cities. So you're going from city to city and playing those particular towns. So it's not like you have a homestand in one city. So it's nightly moving. And so it can be pretty aggressive and tiring.
How much national interest was there? These were exhibition games. They weren't like for standing within the baseball world. They were for entertainment.
Yeah, they were. And, you know, the Deans at that particular time were the greatest names in baseball. They had won 49 regular season games. And, of course, they didn't have all the playoffs like they have now. So you would win your National League and or American League. You go right to the World Series. So they won all four games in the World Series. And the Cardinals are at the peak of their baseball experience in the 30s. It's the Depression. And the Deans decide that they're going to go and barnstorm against, actually they played six games against the Kansas City Monarchs, two games against the New York Black Yankees, two games against the Philadelphia Stars, and three games against the Pittsburgh Crawfords, where they actually see Satchel Paige for the first time.
So a couple of other points of clarification. When we say they, these two guys played these teams, it wasn't just them. They put together an all-star team to join them, right?
Yes. In each city they went, it was a combination of major leaguers, minor leaguers, and even some town ball players. These were, in every town, there was good baseball. So because the money wasn't as large in Major League Baseball, you would get guys who would not leave their jobs. Because a baseball player in those days, when the season finished, they had to go find a job. So people would not leave their jobs if they had family. So there were a great number of outstanding local ball players, Kansas City being one of those examples. And so they would put these all-star teams together. And it was basically orchestrated by a guy named Ray L. Doan out of Muscatine, Iowa, J.L. Wilkinson, who was the co-owner of the Kansas City Monarchs, and, of course, Tom Baird, who was the co-owner of the Kansas City Monarchs, who comes from my hometown.
But what was the drama behind these major leagues players going up against Negro Leagues players?
Well, you had a couple of things going on. First of all, people had not seen the Deans in some of these places because they're going to cities that did not have major league teams. So they're in Oklahoma City, who was in the Texas League, and then they would go to Wichita, who wasn't in a minor league at that year, and they would go to Des Moines, who was in the Western League. So these were not major league towns. So the people were hungry to meet these celebrities that they've been hearing all about. Then in most of those cities, the Monarchs, if you want to use the West, in places like Oklahoma City, the Monarchs had never lost a game. In Wichita, Kansas, they had played like 38 games and lost one. So people wanted to see if anybody could beat these black teams. And so it just created a storm of interest. So much, for instance, when they went to Oklahoma City, the Texas League Stadium there held 7,500 people. Well, they had 15,000 in the park that night. So you can imagine the chaos. And in those days, standing room only was on the ball field. So they encircled the field. So that day, a number of kids got hit with baseballs when players were trying to warm up. And then finally, they had about 12 dozen baseballs. And every time they hit a foul ball, it went into the crowd, and the crowd wouldn't return it. So they had to stop the game after six innings because they had no more baseballs. And I saw a writer when I was going through this. He said it's kind of like running out of coconuts in the jungle.
So the thing about this is, in part, that because baseball is segregated, you have two separate series of competitions going on, and nobody knows how these greats match up against each other.
That is correct. And the other thing is, Dizzy is going to see basically all of the greatest African-American baseball players in existence at that time. So
Dizzy was the one who was really good, right?
Actually, Daffy wasn't bad either. He pitched a no-hitter that year.
I mean, I'm sure they were both good to be in that situation, but like, if you were going to give one of them credit for their celebrity, it's Dizzy,
oh,
right?
Oh, well, yeah, definitely Dizzy. Matter of fact, Dizzy, and I talk about it in the book, he always referred to them as me and Paul. And it was a spinoff of Amos and Andy. And so Paul was kind of the straight man in the whole deal, but Dizzy was colorful, but Paul could be colorful too. And I looked at prior publications when they talked about this. You didn't hear Paul's voice, so I wanted to give a voice to Paul like you had never heard before.
So are there significant moments along the way, you've already told us a couple of them, but significant moments in the course of this barnstorming tour that stand out to you, just where you as a Negro Leagues historian are like, whoa, that's crazy.
Well, I know for me, because I like to talk about politics. I like to talk about a lot of things in my baseball books. And the Dizzy Dean tour was kind of like the perfect storm. So they play in Oklahoma City, and the Monarchs lose the game 4-0. And then in the end of the newspaper, one of the Oklahoma newspapers started talking about how the Deans had restored white supremacy. And so all of a sudden, I don't introduce supremacy, white supremacy. It's introduced by the writers. And so there's little cases like this all throughout the tour. So you can really look at how the writers approached it and how they talked about these games. It was quite fascinating. But for me, it was the perfect storm.
So then, you know, as you look at the reviews or the write-ups of the games and other media surrounding the games, that is a big part of your interest in this.
Yes, yes. We know now that the media didn't always get things right. And, you know, even in Kansas City, for instance, we had a Republican newspaper and a Democratic newspaper. And the Journal Post was the Republican newspaper and the Star Times was the Democrat newspaper. So there were always slants in the newspaper. You just had to know which was which. And so I came into this topic armed with that kind of knowledge. And so, for instance, when the Monarchs played, I'll use the example of Charlie Beverly in Des Moines, Iowa. Charlie Beverly struck out 13 of Dean's All-Stars, but the newspaper never mentioned his name one time. But they talked about the Deans and quite a bit about the Deans, but they forget about Charlie Beverly. Thank God for box scores and me knowing how to read box scores, because it was in the box score. So I was able to bring that to light and maybe why they weren't talking about this. But it happened over and over and over from city to city. So you could see a pattern. One pattern that I thought was interesting is that in the entire series, 14 games, there were only three photographs of African-American players in the newspapers, probably 80 photographs of the Deans.
I mean, part of what you did want to get at with this book was how much the media glossed over the accomplishments of Negro Leagues players during these games. People like Satchel Paige, Chet Brewer, Charlie Beverly, Andy Cooper. Would you like to correct that record now by telling us a little bit of what you didn't hear about these guys at the time?
Well, first of all, I could tell you a lot about the Deans. For instance, I could tell you every hotel they stayed in, but I can't tell you any hotels the Monarchs stayed in. With the Deans, we can look and see what they ate for breakfast, for lunch, and for dinner. The menu is there because they're talking about it, even their snacks. But there's nothing there in detail about the African-American baseball players. So over the years, I was able to interview some of the people like Clint Thomas, who stole home on Dizzy in Brooklyn, New York. Chet Brewer was a really good, close supporter of mine. Georgia Dwight, who was Eddie Dwight's wife, who her husband played center field for the Kansas City Monarchs. And they gave me insight into what they were feeling. These are the things that the voices, you never heard their voices as well. Most people who had done research never interviewed these people. I had the advantage of actually interviewing them going back into the 80s and talking to them about the series and what it meant. And so I was able to bring that to surface. So
you
get
a
different sense.
Can you give an example of what one of these moments did mean to one of these players who had, like, someone stealing third base against Dizzy?
Yeah, well, actually he stole home.
Stole home.
Yeah.
That's a bigger deal.
Yeah, he stole home, and that had never happened to Dizzy before. And it's real interesting because when I originally did the research on the story, I read a biography about Dean, and there were some pretty negative things that Dizzy had said, according to this book, about the guy stealing home. They were derogatory terms. But when I did the research in the newspapers, and I took every newspaper in every town that was available, there was no reference. And then also the guy who originally put these negative statements had no reference in his book either. So I'm pretty sure that these were not positive statements. Actually, they weren't accurate at all, and they certainly weren't positive. So I was able to go in and actually defend Dizzy Dean, which probably nobody expected me to do that as well. But there were lots of things like that. One thing I might mention about Georgia Dwight, the Kansas City Monarchs in 1934, they played four home games. So they're the Kansas City Monarchs, but they're never in Kansas City. And one of those home games was against the Deans. And she was telling me years ago, she said, you know, I only saw my husband three times from April to October. And that was the life of these baseball players who had to barnstorm. And by the way, the Negro Baseball Leagues were America's only barnstorming professional league. So they hold a special place in history.
Phil Dixon, stay with me through a break, okay?
All right.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and when we return, we will hear more from Phil Dixon about his book, The Dizzy and Daphne Dean Barnstorming Tour, Race, Media, and America's National Pastime. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman, talking to historian Phil Dixon. He's a KCK native, out with a new book about Dizzy and Daphne Dean, two brothers who played baseball for the Cardinals. They toured the country playing the stars of the Negro Leagues. And Phil Dixon, welcome back.
Hello.
Can you, you've gone on a barnstorming tour of your own, but it's a tour of libraries in towns where the Monarchs played. Tell me about that.
Yeah, in 2013, I came up with the idea that I could help the racial situation. I felt like the country is being divided more and more, and I knew that baseball is a unifying factor. So I decided that I would go out and basically go to places that the Kansas City Monarchs had once played. And it started out pretty humbly. I think I went to Warrensburg, and then I went over to Osawatomie, Kansas, and it seemed to work. So from that point, I started scheduling.
What do you mean it worked?
It worked because people were open to hear me talk openly about race. And some of the places I went, they had probably not had a black person come in and speak, probably other than a pastor or something. It, you know, in a long time. I'll just put it that way. And so you night after night, you never know who would come out. And it was just one of the most fascinating things.
So your definition of success was just a receptive audience.
That and being able to talk and actually being able to meet people and to put a face to what they were hearing. And people would ask me any question, and I would try to answer. And I got a lot of political questions. But it was truly a fascinating tour. And the unique thing is I drove it all. So I did not take a plane or anything. And it ended up being 17 states, over 200 cities. And I went to Canada as well. Matter of fact, I drove back from Regina, Saskatchewan to Belton, Missouri nonstop. I was so excited that gone well. But when I say barnstorming, I think at one point I did 12 cities in succession. Going across the nation driving. So I speak at night, driving daytime.
What did you talk about, though? I mean, you talked about race and you talked about baseball, but I'm curious to hear some specifics from what you said.
Yeah, I would talk about games the Kansas City Monarchs played in that town, and I would talk about why it was important for them to come to that town. Then I would recognize the people who brought them to that town and what impact they had on, say, Major League Baseball today and integration. And they never looked at themselves in some of these places, some small towns, as having anything to do with the integration of baseball. And so I was able to show them that, yes, you played a role, even though you don't know it. And they were proud to hear that. And, of course, baseball is something that people really enjoy. So I was able to talk about just baseball as well. And it was just truly fascinating. And it's something that you can only do once in life because it was a lot of work. But at the end of it, you know, I just thank God that everything worked out well and no accidents. I'm here today with another book.
Yeah. Can you trace your interest, not just in the subject of this new book, but in the history of Negro Leagues baseball? Because you, in fact, wrote what many people consider to be the seminal history of Negro Leagues baseball. This is not something you have just recently started exploring.
Yeah. I grew up as a baseball fan, and partly because of baseball cards. And as a young person, I started collecting baseball cards by the time I was 19 years old. I had over 100,000 cards, and those were in the days when you couldn't buy a complete set. You had to buy them like by the pack, or either find somebody with a collection they were no longer interested in and talk them into giving it to you. So around my neighborhood, whenever teenage boys found out about girls, I got their cards, basically. And that's how I was able to put a lot of the older sets together. But
and your neighborhood was a neighborhood in KCK?
In KCK, that's right. And a lot of people played baseball. Actually, it was the number one sport that we played. It wasn't football or basketball. It was baseball. And I grew up around the old Heathwood Park. And back in those days, we would walk to the park as a group of kids. And the coach might have 13 uniforms. And so you got five guys coming from the same neighborhood. And the worst thing is somebody's going to get cut. But we didn't have any parents to say, well, come back next year. The coach just said, try again next year. You come back. So luckily I made most of those teams, but a few of my friends didn't. So it was an interesting time.
What was your awareness of the Monarchs growing up?
Eddie Dwight. Well, actually, I might mention when I was born, my father was 49. My mother was 44. So they had lived in the community, you know, long before I arrived. And Eddie Dwight, who played for the Kansas City Monarchs, lived on the next blocks. And so they knew Eddie Dwight real well. Actually, they're professional boxers in my neighborhood. So it was a sporting legacy. But I didn't know any of these players because in the books I was reading, you know, most of the black players started with Jackie Robinson. And, but you would hear somebody play with the Kansas City Monarchs. And so after a while, I got curious. And that one thing led to another. I think I met Carol Ray Mothel in Topeka in 1980. And that pretty much sealed the deal for me. And that's when I became interested also in the Negro League baseball and why it was absent from the history.
Yeah, I mean, it is such a thing to think about that before you wrote your book, there was not a place where that history was collected and documented.
Yeah, it was about three to maybe four books out. at the time that I started. Buck O'Neill used to tell me, he said, I was the one who always started this, not because I wrote the first book, but it was the passion I have. And I still keep that same passion. That's why you can do a 200-city tour.
Yeah.
But the passion. And so I began to talk about people, and even Buck O'Neill, the first documentary done with Buck O'Neill was actually done with me. So it's been an interesting road. And like I said, now even the Dizzy Dean book, what's interesting about the Dizzy Dean book is you don't actually get African-American men writing about old white baseball players. And so I'm breaking new ground in that. It seems like that would be something that would be just typical, but it's not. And so, but I have the knowledge because I've been sitting around baseball all of my life. And so I was able to write about the Deans and shine some new lights on the Deans that other historians had missed. And so I'm really excited about that.
You know, race, sports, and the media still very much overlap in 2019, even though the Negro Leagues are a thing of the past. Do you see reverberations of the historic moment you're chronicling from the 1930s in today's sports media landscape?
Oh, yeah. And I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book and release it now. And that's the reason why the publisher wanted to release it now, because I was able to connect the dots. And so not only do I give you a history of what you're seeing today, I'm able to tell you why you're seeing it today.
What's the Cliff Notes version of that?
Well, the Cliff Note version is that there's nothing new under the sun. But if you know history and you can analyze the history, then you begin to see things that other people miss. And that's what I wanted to show. And even the people who participated in the Dizzy Dean tour, every city they went to had their own promoter. So, for instance, when you got to Philadelphia, the promoter is Eddie Gottlieb. And Eddie Gottlieb, today, the NBA Rookie of the Year Award is called the Eddie Gottlieb Trophy. But he wasn't in basketball, you know, like the NBA then, but he was in baseball. So I'm able to bring these people forward and let you know who they were. Tom Baird, who was the owner of the Kansas City Monarchs, in 1922, he had been identified as a member of the Ku Klux Klan. So I'm able to talk about that. There's more in this book than just pure baseball, but it all makes sense when you look at the world today.
What has changed when it comes to talking about this stuff in the time you've been out in front of discussions about Negro Leagues history in America? You've been researching and writing about Negro Leagues baseball for more than 35 years. And during that time, a lot has changed around race in America, but at the same time, plenty has not changed. And your vantage point on that interests me as a person who's sort of at the center of conversation about it.
Yeah, I've learned a lot over the years. And I wasn't always able to communicate what I knew. And as I write more, I'm able to write about it better. I'm able to communicate it, the thoughts and concepts. And the thing is, I'm not representing any organization or anything like that, so nobody's going to lose any funding when I talk. So I'm able to talk and tell you more truth about what was going on. And so I try to keep an open dialogue and a very honest dialogue, and then also remain receptive for new information, because I'm still a student and still learning every single day.
When you do go around and talk to people, though, even in your sort of humble position as someone who other people consider an authority, but you're calling yourself still a student, when you talk about race and sports just out in the public, has the reception to your ideas changed, or has it stayed pretty much the same?
I think it's changed because the world has changed, where we're dealing with some things today that we might not have been dealing with. For instance, when I'm on my 200-city tour, I'm driving through small towns. And probably if I had driven through these towns maybe 15 years ago, I wouldn't have to look over my shoulder as much as I had to. So when I'm looking over my shoulder here in 2015, 16, 17, I'm starting to understand what these African-American players might have felt when they were traveling in the 20s and 30s. And I was able to bring that forward and to write about it in a way that if I hadn't taken the tour, I might not have ever understood.
Well, our time is up, but Phil Dixon is going to be signing books and talking about all of this research at Barnes & Noble on the Plaza this Sunday, October 6th at 1 o'clock. That's this Sunday at 1. Phil Dixon, author of the Dizzy and Daffy Dean Barnstorming Tour. Thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you very much.
You can check out both of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/Central Standard. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. That's where we keep all of our past shows. And today's show is over, but you can talk to us about what Negro Leagues history means to you as a Kansas Cityan on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and we'd love to hear your stories and your experiences. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Noah Taborda, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and Ann Kniggendorf. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.